From the WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Greil Marcus is the author of the now classic analysis of rock and roll in America, Mystery Train. There's a new revised edition of the book. On today's Fresh Air, Marcus plays us some of the records he wrote about in Mystery Train. Also today, novelist Saul Bellow looks back on his childhood. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles the G and End record labels. In the 1950s, they were among the first labels to produce music with teenagers in mind. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews Siskel and Ebert's new special on the future of the movies. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Defense Secretary Dick Cheney appeared before congressional and administration negotiators who hoped to trim the budget deficit. Cheney outlined the savings possible if defense force levels were cut by 25%. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Budget negotiators are faced with finding cuts of up to $76 billion from a federal budget deficit that could reach $140 billion next fiscal year. Cheney disappointed Democrats by proposing a plan that reduces spending just 10%. Afterwards, the defense secretary indicated the administration is not yet ready to make concessions on defense.
Obviously, what I told him is that the budget we would like to have is the one we submitted, the one the president sent up, that it gets us to the level of funding that we wanted. It also does it in a way that we think makes sense.
Democrat Les Aspin, chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, said he wouldn't accept Cheney's plan and said his Senate counterpart Sam Nunn, "I don't think we're finished with defense." This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
Oil from the tanker Megaborg is stalled 7 to 10 miles off the Texas coast. Currents and wind conditions have kept it from coming ashore, and salvage crews are waiting to transfer the oil that remains on the ship to another tanker. Kathy Lohr has more.
Crews are moving oil from the tank on the Megaborg that was leaking to three other tanks on board. They're trying to make sure oil vapors don't reignite the fire that burned for nearly a week. Operators hope to begin offloading the oil tomorrow or Thursday. The ship had a 38-million-gallon cargo when it exploded 11 days ago. The Coast Guard now says about 4 million gallons of the light crude are missing. Officials revised their estimate after finding some oil in a recovery tank that they thought had leaked into the Gulf. The ship has stopped leaking oil, but officials still don't know how much remains in the water. Skimmers have collected 250,000 gallons of oil and water so far. Meanwhile, there are still no results from a bioremediation experiment, which attempted to use microbes to eat the oil. For National Public Radio, I'm Kathy Lohr reporting.
The South African Parliament repealed a major apartheid law today. Called the Separate Amenities Act, it was the law used for decades to segregate public facilities ranging from restaurants to libraries to buses. In major cities such as Johannesburg and Cape Town, public facilities have been integrated for years. The repeal of the law will mean the most in small towns and villages, where there are either no public facilities for black people or vastly inferior segregated ones. The repeal won't affect segregation of neighborhoods or of schools. Stock prices on Wall Street rebounded a bit today after yesterday's 53-point plunge. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 11 points to close at 2,893.56. Advances led declines in light trading. This is NPR. The House Banking Committee today released documents that outline a string of alleged conflict of interest abuses by President Bush's son, Neil. Neil Bush was a director of the Denver-based Silverado Savings and Loan, which collapsed in 1988 at an estimated cost to taxpayers of at least $1 billion. The charges against Bush include a deal in which Silverado allegedly wrote off an $11 million loan to one of his business partners. The partner had planned to give $3 million to Bush's oil company. The documents were released at a House Banking Committee hearing on Silverado today. Bush denied any wrongdoing in testimony before the committee last month. The eastern Ohio town of Shadyside is continuing to dig out from Thursday night's flash flood that killed at least 21 people. Bill Cohen of Ohio Public Radio reports.
It's been 5 days since the 25-foot-high wall of creek water swept away cars, houses, and people. and only now has the scene dried up enough to let bulldozers work into the evening hours, clearing away debris and searching for the missing. More than 400 National Guardsmen are in town to help with the effort. Disaster agency officials say last night, for the first time, floodlights were set up, allowing debris-clearing crews to work until 2 in the morning. They say 35 truckloads of debris were hauled away, and that didn't begin to scale down the mountain of smashed cars, downed trees, and splintered houses. A disaster center has now opened up, offering low-interest loans to businesses that were hit and offering outright grants to homeowners for rebuilding. For National Public Radio, this is Bill Cohen.
A proposed constitutional amendment to ban desecration of the American flag is on its way to the House floor. The measure passed through the House Judiciary Committee by a vote of 19-17, but the committee made no recommendation either for or against it. 5 Democrats joined with 14 Republicans to vote for the measure. The full House could vote on the measure as early as Thursday. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Greil Marcus was one of the first critics to write about rock and roll as seriously as others had written about literature and film. He was the first record review editor at Rolling Stone magazine. He now writes a music column for The Village Voice and a book column for California Magazine. Greil Marcus's 1975 book, Mystery Train, is still considered one of the seminal works of rock criticism. He said he didn't set out to write a history or a purely musical analysis or a set of personality profiles. He wanted to broaden the context in which rock and roll is heard, to deal with rock and roll not as youth culture or counterculture, but simply as American culture. A revised edition of Mystery Train has just been published. We invited Marcus to talk with us about some of the ideas in the book and to play some of the records he wrote about. He connects rock and roll to the American impulse to escape from restraints and authority.
The real American story is this wish to escape, is the classic Huck Finn lighting out for the territory, but also then, after the escape has been made, coming to terms with the home that's been left behind, and in one of many senses, returning to that home. So there's a real pull in both directions. It's not simply a story of escape and rebellion. And I think, you know, that comes through most clearly, perhaps, in the story of Elvis Presley and in the story of Sly Stone, both people who, in a sense, made their escapes from the cultures they'd inherited and brought up in, and were basically destroyed by their inability to find their way to any kind of home.
You know, in trying to define the essence of rock and roll, you go back to an obscure singer named Harmonica Frank, someone who I should say I've never heard, although I've read about him in your book. What are some of the qualities that he had that you think foreshadowed rock and roll?
Well, what interested me about Harmonica Frank, he was a white medicine show performer. He began performing in the 20s and kept playing and singing all around the country up until the 1950s when he made his first records, and then for a good 25 years after that. He was someone who drew on every style of American vernacular music that he could get his hands on: blues, country, scatological songs, commercial jingles, everything anybody wanted to hear and would give him a dime for. And in 1951, in Memphis, when Sam Phillips was starting Sun Records and was beginning to get this idea that if he could find a white man who could get the feeling of black music, he could make a lot of money. He stumbled on Harmonica Frank, who people who heard him sing often thought was black because he seemed to have absorbed the black feel as much as any other white man. And so Sam Phillips thought, well, I'll give it a try. I'll record this guy. And he did, and he made remarkable records. And they don't so much foreshadow rock and roll in terms of musical style, but they definitely foreshadow it in terms of impulse, in terms of an attempt of whites to cross over and really attach themselves to what up until that point, and in many ways still today, is considered someone else's culture.
You brought something of Harmonica Frank's to play for us. What did you bring?
I brought a song called Going Away Walkin', which is a country blues. And to me, it's his strongest, most moving performance. I don't know if it's his most typical. It's not one of the ones where he plays two harmonicas at the same time, one in his mouth held like a cigar and the other one with his nose, also singing at the same time. But it's a pretty strong piece of music.
Why don't we give it a listen?
Okay.
It's Harmonica Frank, one of the records that Greil Marcus has brought with us. And Harmonica Frank is one of the people Greil writes about in his book Mystery Train, which has just been published in a new edition. Well, let's move on to Robert Johnson, another musician who you write about in Mystery Train. And you describe Johnson as the most emotionally committed of blues singers. Now, what impact do you think Robert Johnson has on rock and roll? What is it about him that connects to rock and roll?
Well, Johnson's had an enormous impact on guitar players, on singers. He was a blues singer, was born in 1911. He was murdered in 1938, was from Mississippi. And he was a great musician, but he was also a dark and confused and in some ways almost nihilist figure, both in terms of the legend of his life and the songs that he wrote. Songs like Hellhound on My Trail is probably his most famous and most emblematic. And he's become a kind of shadow hero to all kinds of musicians. A figure who represents how far you can really go in pursuit of your own music. But Johnson appealed to me in trying to construct a tradition that would begin to make sense of rock and roll as a kind of American culture, because it seemed that he captured more deeply than any other musician the sense of doubt and contingency and uncertainty that lies behind any impulse toward rebellion or escape. I mean, this was a man who lived an itinerant life, who left everyone behind at one time or another, whose songs are filled with regret at the fact that he has to live a life without any kind of solace. And it is not a celebration. It is not... I don't need anybody. I'm my own man. I'm free. It's about the doubts that come with freedom, and I've never heard that expressed more powerfully than in his music.
What did you bring by Robert Johnson to play for us?
I brought a song called "Come On in My Kitchen," which is maybe the most delicate of all of his recordings. It was recorded in 1936.
Did Robert Johnson have on you when you first started listening to his records?
Well, I discovered Robert Johnson's music in 19, 70, right after the Altamont Rock Festival or whatever the hell it was, the great Rolling Stones show with 300,000 people that was, you know, utterly dominated by violence and beating and horror and ended with murder, which was probably the ugliest day of my whole life up to that point. And after I left that concert sick of rock and roll, just full of confusion and disgust, and I needed to listen to something else. And I stumbled on a Robert Johnson album, and I saw that, oh, there's a song on here. It's the same song Cream recorded. I wonder why it's the same title. So I bought it and took it home. I didn't listen to anything else for the next year.
But you got back to rock and roll, I guess.
Oh, yeah. I got back.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. Greil Marcus is my guest. And his book, Mystery Train, which is a kind of classic of rock criticism, has just been published in a new edition. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Rock critic Greil Marcus is my guest. We're talking about his new book, Mystery Train, which has just been published in a new edition. Let's move on to Elvis Presley, another one of the performers who you write about, Mystery Train. You describe Elvis as a great artist, a great rocker, a great purveyor of schlock, a great heartthrob, a great bore, a great symbol of potency, a great ham, a great nice person, and yes, a great American. Now, Elvis Presley was often accused of being like the supreme example of the white person who stole music from blacks, passed it off as original, made a fortune, while the black originators remained obscure. And you really think that that attitude is nonsense?
Yeah, I do. I think it's one of the great simplicities that we cling to avoid having to think about where our culture really comes from, what it really does, and what it's really about. I think the idea that an utterly a white Mississippi boy like Elvis Presley from an utterly impoverished background who listened to black music on the radio against his parents' wishes, who had to find for himself as a teenager a life that he could call his own, that he actually wanted to live, and began to do that by sneaking across town into black neighborhoods, finding black girlfriends, who began to haunt Beale Street, who began to go into the black social clubs where music was played every weekend, and ultimately got up the nerve to ask if he could sing for the crowd too, something that was absolutely unheard of in Memphis in 1953, 1954, for a white kid to walk in and want to play and then do it and have the people who listened to the greatest blues singers in the country every weekend cheer him and say, there's something different here, there's something fresh. That was a revolutionary act. The idea that he stole that music as opposed to made it his own is a cheap way of saying, we white people have our culture, black people have their culture. What's wrong with that? You know, separate but equal. And I think, you know, that disgraceful ideology has persisted in culture with a tinge of legitimacy far more than it's persisted in politics. Not that it hasn't persisted in truth in politics, but the legitimacy is gone.
But do you think there have been examples, even if Elvis Presley isn't one of them, of white musicians ripping off black culture and passing it off as their own?
Oh, there's no question about it. I mean, it's, you know, one of the most commonplace stories we've got. But what interests me, what I think is much more paradoxical, much more fun to listen to, much more fun to write about, is when a white musician finds something in black music that he actually can contribute to, that he can bring something of himself to that music or herself to that music rather than simply taking, or vice versa. Sly Stone, another of the people that I write about, a black musician, was utterly energized by white music, by Bob Dylan, by the Beatles, by all kinds of music. And he had no interest whatsoever in performing music that anyone could pigeonhole as black. He wanted to be, in Albert Murray's wonderful phrase, an omni-American.
Grill Marcus is my guest, and his book about rock and roll Mystery Train has just been published in a new edition. You named your book after one of Elvis Presley's early recordings, Mystery Train.
Right.
Why did you name your whole book after that one record?
Well, it wasn't really till I had finished writing the book, and I ended a very long chapter on Elvis Presley with some talk about that song, Mystery Train, that it suddenly struck me that this one song probably contained more of the contradictions that I was trying to talk about between escape and homecoming, between rebellion and acceptance, than any other song that I'd come across. Plus, it's a great title.
Yeah.
It's a great title. It was a great title for that song. It was a good title for my book. Jim Jarmusch liked it for his movie. A new book of poems by someone named David Wohan has just come out with the same title. There's a record store in Boston called Mystery Train Records. It's irresistible.
Why don't we hear it? This is Elvis Presley's recording of Mystery Train. It's one of his early Sun Sessions.
Well, that long black train got my baby and gone.
Elvis Presley's Mystery Train. You know, one of the really fascinating things that makes Elvis Presley as complex as he was is some of the other influences that go in there along with the black music influences. People, and you mentioned this in your book, people like Dean Martin and Mario Lanza, who you don't really think of as being his influences. But I think you can hear that kind of like deep mumbly quality of Dean Martin in his singing.
Oh, yeah, and you can hear, you know, the wish to really be a bel canto blues singer. I mean, everything feeds in, you know, whether it's country music, whether it's, I guess you just said Mario Lanza. I mean, you can hear a lot of that.
Your book, Mystery Train, was first written in the mid-1970s. It was published in the mid-1970s.
Right.
I want to ask you about a current form of music, and that is rap. It's one of the most popular forms of music now, yet it's probably the music that's most under attack. A lot of early rock and roll was very controversial with parents and teachers, you know, PTAs, and people, you know, a lot of adults were really afraid of the influence this raucous sexual music was going to have on their youth. Do you see rap as an extension of that in any way?
Well, it certainly seems to be drawing the heat. I think what we're faced with now, I mean, thinking of Two Live Crew in Florida, where it seems as if the entire Bill of Rights has been abrogated, I think there has been an urge in this country for a long time to find scapegoats. I think the right in this country is looking desperately for an issue now that the abortion issue seems to be falling away from them. I think Two Live Crew at this point are absolutely classic scapegoats because they're black and because they sing about sex. The Newsweek cover, the notorious Newsweek cover, has rap gone too far, whatever the exact wording was a classic example of what some critical theorists like to call the dominant society attempting to suppress anything different. That was a pure piece of racism and scare stuff. I think this is part and parcel with trying to drum up hysteria over flag burning. And I think whenever you have black people talking out loud and not really attempting to shade what they're saying for anybody's benefit, they're going to be targets.
I should mention here that you're on the record of as having serious problems with at least one rap group and things that they've done, and that's Public Enemy. There's a Village Voice annual pop music poll that you refuse to participate in. You want to explain your rationale for that?
Well, I think a lot of what Public Enemy has done is utterly disgraceful. Mm-hmm. I think there are many of the things that they've put out are racist, they're anti-Semitic, they're homophobic, they're viciously sexist, and I think the way that they have been treated by many, many white critics is in some ways even at least as disgusting as and reprehensible as what the group itself has done, which is to say they've just been given complete dispensation because, I mean, these guys are really down on the street and they're saying what's happening and they're hip and they're black and maybe they're not smart enough to know that anti-Semitism isn't cool, but they're where it's at. That is just as racist coming from a white critic as jumping on Two Live Crew because they speak a language that, you know, some white people don't want to hear. So I'm perfectly happy, you know, as a listener, to attack something that I think is corrupt. And I think a lot of what Public Enemy does is corrupt. But there's no question their music is powerful. There's no question that Chuck D, their leader, is a thoughtful, tough-minded, smart guy, and you know, he's somebody worth reckoning with. My opposition to that group or to a lot of what it does doesn't exist in the realm of saying I want them to stop saying that. They shouldn't be allowed to say that. People shouldn't listen to it.
Mm-hmm.
I was making a protest against the dispensation I thought that many people at The Voice were offering this band.
Well, Greil, we're just about out of time. Why don't we end with maybe a record that you wish you had included in your book, Mystery Train, in retrospect? Is there
All
such
right.
a record?
Well, sure. One thing that Mystery Train is not about is women.
Uh-huh.
That's something that's left out of the book. And were I to really sit down and were I to write the book today, the book is written, the book is what it is, but were I to write it today, that would be something that I'd have to wrestle with. And I think, you know, I might write about Laurie Anderson, or I might write about the Chantels, black New York City girl group from the 50s. They recorded only a very, very few songs that really count. And it'd be a real challenge to try and make a world out of those few songs. They had a singer named Arlene Smith, 15 years old, maybe the strongest voice in all of rock and roll. I'd like to write about that.
Before we hear from Arlene Smith and the Chantels, let me thank you, Greil Marcus, very much for talking with us.
It's always a pleasure.
Greil Marcus's book, Mystery Train, is just out in its third revised edition, published by Dutton. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air, and this is the Chantels.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, Nobel Prize-winning writer Saul Bellow tells us how the street language he heard as a child influenced his fiction. Also, TV critic David Bianculli reviews a new special featuring George Lucas, Steven Spielberg, and Martin Scorsese. And rock historian Ed Ward remembers G&N Records. They were responsible for a slew of teen hits by groups like the Chantels and Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Faced with political challenges from the left and the right, Soviet leader Gorbachev defended his record today before a meeting of some 3,000 Communist Party members. He warned his opponents that they could end up by destroying the party. NPR's Ann Gerrels reports from Moscow.
It was, according to one Soviet official, an unprecedented exchange of criticism at a Communist Party meeting. Fighting for the survival of a unified Communist Party, Gorbachev appealed for moderation. He lashed out at conservatives who opposed his moves to a market economy, saying they lost touch with reality a long time ago. At the other extreme is the Democratic Platform, a group of party rebels which demands the party end its stranglehold of power and compete on a normal democratic basis. Gorbachev told these critics they risk gutting the party of all its political power. His opponents fought back, each saying now is the last chance to win back the confidence of the people. Today's confrontation was a preview of the fragmentation expected at an emergency Congress of the National Communist Party in 10 days. I'm Ann Gerrels in Moscow.
Washington has decided to boycott the inauguration tomorrow of Romanian President Iliescu because of last week's crushing of dissent. A State Department spokesman indicated today concern that the government of Romania may be using arrest to intimidate people who are taking part in peaceful protest. Richard Boucher said there is concern that officials in Bucharest have taken no action against minors and others who were responsible for most of last week's mob violence. The controversy over an exhibition of photographs by the late Robert Mapplethorpe continues in Cincinnati even after the show has closed. Lorna Jordan of member station WVXU has this report.
The Cincinnati Contemporary Arts Center and its director, Dennis Berry, were charged on two misdemeanor counts each of pandering obscenity and illegally showing photographs of nude children. Today, Hamilton County Judge David Albanese refused to dismiss one obscenity count and set a September 24th trial date to hear those charges. The judge also scheduled another hearing in August on the second obscenity count. Dennis Berry, however, expected all the charges to be dropped.
I think the world outside of Cincinnati believed that they would be dropped. And everywhere there was a sense that this would not go to trial because they didn't understand how it could go to trial.
The museum and its director were indicted the day the exhibition opened to the public in early April. The show closed last month and will move to Boston. For National Public Radio, I'm Lorna Jordan in Cincinnati.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 11 points today to close at 2,893.56 on trading of some 135 million shares. Trading was light. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. It's hard to believe there was a time when there were no records produced by and for teenagers, but rock and roll historian Ed Ward says that was pretty much the story until producers George Goldner and Morris Levy came along in the late 50s.
Boom, boom, boom. Who's you? Ooh, bop, bop. Who's you? Ooh, bop, bop. Who's you? Ooh, bop, bop. Bop, bop, bop. Bop, bop, bop.
Just what is rock and roll, anyway? A big question. Too big, really. But when we look at the music of the 1950s, it's a question with some validity, particularly as regards black music. I recently got a letter from a listener who said he had it figured out. Rhythm and blues, he said, was music made for adults. Rock and roll was music made for teenagers. Not a bad distinction, but one that's often hard to make stick. Some black artists, Ray Charles comes to mind, made both kinds of music. There were some teenagers who made music for adults, and some adults who made music for teenagers. But with G and End, the record labels run by George Goldner and the late Morris Levy, who died a couple of weeks ago after a spectacular career in the music business and organized crime, it's a lot easier to tell. Legend has it that the lyrics to Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers' Why Do Fools Fall in Love came from a poem Frankie wrote to a teacher he had a crush on. Unfortunately, that's not the case, but what's more important and what really sold the song is that they very well could have been. The teen appeal of the song comes not only from the lyrics and from 13-year-old Frankie's delivery, but from the up-tempo beat, which is danceable without being the sort of wild jump blues sort of tempo that rhythm and blues vocal groups used for their fast numbers. Why Do Fools Fall in Love was the vindication of George Goldner's belief that he could produce vocal group records for teenagers. It was the first in a long string of hits on G and End, the names of which came from things teenagers said, like, gee, that's the living end. Goldner liked working with teenagers. He'd started by producing pre-rock and roll vocal music, songs like G by the Crows and Sunday Kind of Love by the Harptones, which he'd put on his salsa label, Rama. With G and End, he specifically targeted teens, though, and after two hits in a row in the first 3 months of 1956, he knew he was on a roll.
Oh, little girl of mine, gee, you sure look fine. Yes, you appeal to me. I'll never set you free.
Little Girl of Mine by the Cleftones was the formula in a nutshell. Teen-oriented lyrics, a busy vocal arrangement supporting the lead, and that all-important medium up-tempo rhythm. Goldner even felt confident enough to try message songs for teens.
I'm not a juvenile delinquent.
No, no.
Don't blame Frankie Lyman for those lyrics, though. They were by Morris Levy. Levy was a good guy to have on your side. As Alan Freed's manager, he had some influence with Freed, the number one rock and roll disc jockey in the country. And thanks to his other friends, he probably had quite a bit of influence in the jukebox trade, too. But all the influence in the world wouldn't have done any good without good records to sell. Goldner just got better and better. Here's a record he made with an astonishing 14-year-old singer whom he pushed past the limits of her endurance to get an unforgettable performance. Arlene Smith and the Chantels never topped that moment. G and End lasted through 1962, by which time Levy's mind was on other record companies like Roulette and on his nightclub, Birdland. The last hit on End showed that the teens of 1956 had become more sophisticated and that Goldner's touch with the classics was better than ever.
Are the stars out tonight? I don't know if it's cloudy or bright.
G&N brought New York vocal group music into the rock and roll mainstream. They also were among the first to release albums by their groups, which often showed white teenagers on the covers to make them easier to sell. Goldner and Levy were pioneers in marketing to teenagers, but most importantly, they helped get a lot of good music onto wax.
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. Saul Bellow is perhaps the United States' most honored living writer, having received the Nobel, the Pulitzer, and three National Book Awards. Book critic Michiko Kakutani once described Bellow as creating characters who are caught in the middle of a spiritual crisis and frightened by the stubborn fact of death. Bellow was born in Montreal in 1915, but grew up in Chicago, where he lives today and where many of his novels are set. His books include The Adventures of Augie March, Seize the Day, Herzog, Humboldt's Gift, and Henderson the Rain King. I spoke with him last fall when his novella The Bella Rosa Connection was published. I asked him to elaborate on something he wrote in a 1987 essay. Bellow wrote, "As a Middle Westerner and son of immigrant parents, I recognized at an early age that I was called upon to decide for myself to what extent my Jewish origins, my surroundings, my schooling were to be allowed to determine the course of my life."
Well, I think that at a very early age, I think before puberty, I'd already decided that I wanted to be a writer, and this really drew me apart from my family.
Your father had been a businessman.
Well, my father had been the usual rabbinical student who came to America and found nothing better to do than business. And he didn't do it too well. He was not rigidly orthodox. I was not imposed on that way. I just wanted to go my own way. And I did.
You also said that you think you might have become a rabbi if the great world, the world of the streets, had not been so seductive. What was seductive? What did you see? And what do you mean by the world of the streets? What exactly were you exposed to?
I mean Chicago in the 20s. I mean the streets, street life, pool rooms, sports, a modicum of criminal activity, which was inescapable in Chicago during the 20s, the bang-bang time of Prohibition and so on, just the sense that you were participating in the life of this immense and expanding civilization, which was so fascinating that it drew me away from my Jewishness, not so as to make me forget it, but that I wanted to combine it with other things. I mean, I was deeply unwilling to follow anybody's blueprint from either side of the equation.
I've got to ask, you mentioned something about criminal activity. Were you involved in petty crimes yourself?
Well, every kid is involved in petty crimes, always a certain amount of theft and shoplifting and criminal intentions, which are much more powerful than the crimes you commit when you're a kid.
Were you ever caught for anything?
No. I wasn't. No, I never. I was never interested in shoplifting at Woolworths and things like that that people used to get caught at. But if I were working in a department store, as I once did, say at a barrel of surprise packages for Christmas, for a quarter apiece, my buddy and I, who were dressed as Santa Claus's helpers, would pocket an occasional quarter. Never got caught.
Mm-hmm.
But I never went in for big-time dishonesty.
Right. So when you were growing up, did you read a lot, too?
Yes, I did.
Did that let you in on other worlds outside Chicago?
Oh, immensely. That was really terrific. Of course, the first book I read was... the first books I read were the opening books of the Old Testament, which I read in Hebrew and translated into Yiddish, which made an enduring impression on me.
Pretty ambitious for starting out, huh?
Well, I think this is the way Jewish kids started out in traditional Orthodox families.
Now, you went to New York for the first time, I think, when you were 17. You went to sell your first novel. I'm thinking of how much confidence you must have had in yourself to, at the age of 17, think that you had a chance of selling it to a publisher.
It wasn't I that went to New York at 17. It was my pal, Sidney Harris.
Oh, I thought you went with him.
No, no, no. I didn't go with him.
Oh.
No, I had to stay at home and face the music.
Which was what?
Which was that I had conspired with him to run away to New York. He had written a novel. We were both schoolboys, high school boys. I wrote the introduction to the novel, which was nearly as long, I think. Then we tossed a coin to see who would take it to New York to be published. He won the toss. So without a moment's hesitation, he tucked the manuscript under his sweater and he took off. I had to answer to his mother.
What'd you tell her?
He was an only child. I wouldn't tell her anything, of course, because that would be squealing. Though I was a literary type, I was also brought up in Chicago, and I knew how bad it was to squeal. So I kept my mouth shut. And his mother, who was an English woman, Cockney lady, and my eldest brother, who was in the habit of policing me, took me down to the Missing Persons Bureau. We went downtown on the streetcar, and I was confronted by the cops in the Missing Persons Bureau. "Where is Sidney J. Harris?" I wouldn't talk. That was bad, but my brother, when he got home, broke into the only private lock drawer I ever had in boyhood, and he found letters that Sidney had been sending me, and so the game was up.
So what was the outcome of the book?
Well, he went to an old Chicago bookseller who had set up in New York in the early 30s as an independent publisher. His name was Pat Cavici. And Pat was very impressed with his gifts and offered him an advance to do another book, not this one, which I have to admit was not much good, neither his book nor my introduction, announcing him as a great genius, coming genius, and denouncing bourgeois America and so on. We were 16 at the time.
So what did get you to New York? And you lived in New York from, well, through part of the 40s through the 60s, is that right?
Well, that's where New York was, where the action was. And if you were interested in the literary life, you couldn't stay in Chicago anymore because the great literary days of Chicago were definitely finished by the middle of the Depression years. And anybody who was somebody had already gone off. So I went to New York. I hitchhiked to New York a few times to start a literary career. And somehow I did.
In your book, Humboldt's Gift, you refer to, quote, the fastidious Goy critics on guard for the Protestant establishment and the genteel tradition. Now, you were really one of the first of the modern Jewish novelists to really make it and reach a wide audience in America. Did you ever feel when you were starting out that you were up against a non-Jewish establishment who might keep you out?
Well, it always helps a young writer to be a belligerent. Militancy is what he chugs along on. So you have to discount. You have to enter a discount for some of this.
Uh-huh.
It's true that we had the experience of first of being locked out, and then of being admitted partly as under the aspect of curiosity. You know, I mean, as Samuel Johnson said about lady poets. They're like dogs that walk on their hind legs. The miracle, what is interesting is not that they do it badly, but that they can do it at all. And I think that this was the category I felt myself being thrust in, and I didn't really like it very much.
What gave you that feeling?
I was battlesome. Well, you know, we had no sooner arrived and begun publishing books, people like Malamud and I, and later on Roth, than we were tagged as Jewish writers. Nobody wants to be tagged in that way. I mean, we thought of ourselves as belonging to the mainstream. We were Americans of Jewish origin. That didn't mean that we had to be tagged that way. And I, for one, really didn't like it. And I jokingly named Roth, Malamud, and myself as the Hartshaffner and Marx of American literature. But that stuck rather. I mean, the idea that that you were not a full partner in this enterprise.
In 1975, in a piece in Newsweek, you expressed your fear of being elevated to grand old man status, and you said that that's a way of just being eased out. I was wondering if you still are concerned about that, and if you feel you've tried to.
I'm not concerned about it at all. I just don't do it.
Don't do what? What would be required of you?
In my time, I've watched writers and poets playing this role, and I just don't care for it.
What's the role specifically that you're talking about?
Oh, the sort of Robert Frost grand old man role, you know. I am now the spokesman of my generation, or I am the spokesman for America, and so I've never considered myself that kind of spokesman.
So are there things that you turn down because you don't want to play that role? Certain speaking invitations or certain things that you are asked to write? Certain stands you are
well,
expected to take?
Well, I turn down invitations because I don't want to waste my time. That is to say, if I didn't have anything better to do, I might accept them and go forth and glitter as a public figure. But since I'm too busy, I turn them aside for the most part.
Novelist Saul Bellow, this is Fresh Air. Things are a little hectic in the All Things Considered newsroom right now, but I can fill you in on a couple of the stories they're following. On the eve of Nelson Mandela's visit to the U.S., Robert Siegel talks with reporter Alistair Sparks in South Africa about the pressures on the South African government. Also, a report on a conference in London to revise the 1987 International Agreement on Protecting the Ozone Layer. Michael Scholar has that story. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Film critics Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert have a syndicated one-hour special on the future of the movies. Many local TV stations will be showing it sometime before the end of June. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
The last time we saw Siskel and Ebert in a one-hour special, and it was only a few weeks ago, they were hosting a CBS program that was full of movie stars and spent much of its time plugging upcoming film projects. This new special, though, gets back to basics. It spends its time with directors, not stars, and less than a minute is devoted to an upcoming movie by any of them. Instead, the emphasis, as the show's title says, is on the future of the movies. And the three directors interviewed, all in their 40s, are bound to be a big part of that future. Siskel talks with Steven Spielberg, Ebert talks with George Lucas, and both of them talk with Martin Scorsese, probably so one critic wouldn't get more airtime than the other. Part of the talk in the future of the movies is devoted to what we're not likely to see in the future, as when Siskel asks Spielberg about the likelihood of a sequel to his most popular film.
You're going to get this question till you drop, the E.T. sequel. Mm-hmm. In the 90s?
No. Go further.
2010?
No.
2020?
No. It ended. It was a wonderful love affair. And then it was over. And then Elliot went back to his life, and E.T. went back to his planet.
Another thing not to expect from a Spielberg film is an explicit love scene.
What about the ultimate sexual encounter? a truly close encounter.
Moi? To film that? I've always been embarrassed by screen sexuality. It's always embarrassed me.
Ebert, though, gets more positive news from Lucas, who says he's almost ready to begin the next trilogy of Star Wars stories.
It's really about, Obi-Wan Kenobi as a boy. And
can't imagine him as a boy.
Well, he was a boy, and so was, Anakin Skywalker, mm-hmm. and who became Darth Vader eventually. And, it's those characters and how they ended up getting where they were.
As for the future of cinema in general, Lucas, Spielberg, and Scorsese all agree that the films themselves won't last much longer unless they're restored and preserved properly. It's pretty shocking to hear Spielberg say that the original negative for Jaws is in terrible shape after only 15 years. And everyone on the show complains that studio heads don't protect and preserve film libraries as their most valuable asset. Surprisingly, no credit for film restoration is given to Ted Turner, who does precisely that. But maybe these directors and critics can't praise Turner for his restoration work while they're still angry at him for colorization. Anyway, this special takes its topics and its guests seriously, and gives the audience credit for much more intelligence than Siskel and Ebert's CBS special did. That's why this new special deserves an audience. So watch for it. I give it one thumb up.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Joan Tuohy and Roberta Shurrock. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, coffee. Food writer Corby Kummer tells us how to buy it, how to brew it, and what the medical experts have to say about it. Also, Lloyd Schwartz on a new recording of Two Schubert Masses, and John Leonard on a paleontologist's view of Atlantis. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.